For the last few weeks, I've been talking about investing, and I may finish up that section today. I hope to. We'll see if I get that far. I'm talking now about how and where to invest. We looked, first of all, at the power of compound interest and what can happen to money invested over time at different rates of return and how that can it can grow into quite a sum. And then last Sunday, I talked about different methods and ways to actually do the investing in different retirement accounts. And then today I want to talk about a couple of other, another strategy, and then a couple of other types of investments, and then also financial advisors and how to pick one of those if we get that far. Before I do that, I have a couple of things that I want to cover that I didn't cover last Sunday. One of the things I just learned about, I talked about a solo 401k for people who are self-employed, which doesn't apply to a lot of people, but for anybody that doesn't have any employees, a solo 401k is a way that you can invest a lot more in retirement. The maximums are a lot higher per year. I also mentioned there's a bunch of headache that goes along with that, a lot of paperwork, a lot of forms, a lot of records that have to be kept. And so it didn't seem like a very good deal to me. And then I was talking to a financial advisor this week, and he mentioned a SEP IRA, which is a self-employed IRA. And it accomplishes basically the same thing, only it's a lot simpler. And a self-employed person can put 25% of his income into this per year, up to a maximum of $70,000 per year. Now, that's not $70,000 income. That's actual $70,000 invested in the IRA. So you'd have to make like $280,000. At 25% to put the max in. So, you know, you have to make pretty good money. But it's like setting up a regular IRA. So it's simple. There's not a lot of paperwork and headache and that kind of thing. Not that this would apply to anybody, but just for your knowledge, if you are self-employed and you have no employees, that's a great deal. If you have employees, you have to contribute the same amount to every employee of the company. So if you wanted to max out yours at 25%, you'd also have to put 25% in theirs, and of course that would get pretty expensive. So it's good for somebody with no employees. It's not so good for people with a bunch of them. Last time I did talk about Dave Ramsey's method of investing. Just to recap that, he recommends that you put 15% of your gross income into either a company IRA and then company 401k and Roth IRAs and fill up the Roths before you go back to the 401k. And then he recommends 25% in each of the categories of growth, growth and income, aggressive growth, and international. So big companies, small companies, international, and things like that. I also talked about Carlton Moore and his take on it. Just invest in the S&P and keep things simple. One thing I did want to mention, somebody asked me a question about this after the service last Sunday. I talked about individual brokerage accounts, discount brokerage accounts like Charles Schwab or E-Trade or Fidelity or Robinhood, or there's a bunch of them out there. And somebody asked, what does it cost to open one of these things? And the answer is it doesn't cost anything. It's free. So you can open a Charles Schwab account for nothing. I have one. My wife even has one. And then trades are also free. So you don't pay anything for anything. You can go in there, you can buy and sell stocks, you can buy and sell ETFs, mutual funds, whatever you want. It's all free. It doesn't cost you anything. So that can be a good deal depending on what your financial situation is and so on. You do the downside to that is, though, you do every time you sell something in there, you will owe capital gains tax on it, either short or long term, like I talked about last time. So the advantage of the IRAs is you can buy and sell within there and you don't owe any capital gains tax. You don't have to keep any records. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. You just pay the tax either up front or you pay it when you take it out at the end, depending on what type of account it is. But I covered all that before. Another thing I wanted to mention, I assume this goes without saying, but if you need help picking mutual funds for your 401k or evaluating mutual funds in your 401k or evaluating a financial advisor, you can always ask me. You can always, I'd be happy to help you out, and that you don't have to tell me your income. You don't have to tell me how much is in your account. You don't have to tell me how much you're putting in per month. You don't have to tell me any, no numbers at all. Just say, hey, here are the funds in my 401k. List, you know, just get the names of the funds and the ticker symbols. And then I can go and I can do the research and look at them and see how they did over, you know, the course of, you know, the last 10 years or so. And if they kept up with the market or outpaced it, and I can help you out with that if you need any help. Or evaluating financial advisors. Because the thing is, with a financial advisor, and I'll talk about this hopefully at the end of the sermon, if not next Sunday. If you don't know much and you go talk to a financial advisor, unless he really sits down and explains everything to you, and even if he did, if you don't know much, he could make anything sound good to you and put you in crappy stuff like annuities or whole life insurance or whatever, all kinds of other bad investments. And if you don't know any different, you don't know any different. It's like going to a mechanic if you don't know anything about cars. He could tell you anything's wrong. I mean, you know, we need to change out the muffler bearing and put some headlight oil in there, and it's going to cost you $250. And you're like, well, I guess that's what he said, you know, which you don't, you know, if you don't know anything, it's a good idea to take somebody else with you or run the diagnosis by somebody that knows what they're talking about. So anyway, I always want to verify what any financial advisor tells you with somebody else that you know and trust, that knows something about it. Oh, let's see. Was there anything else? Okay, that's about it, I think. So I want to talk now about another strategy out there. And there are many strategies, obviously. But these three that I've given you, Ramsey's, Moore's, and now Schiff's, these are three that I'm quite familiar with. So Peter Schiff is the owner of Euro Pacific Asset Management, used to be Euro Pacific Capital, and he's also the owner of Schiff Gold. And he recommends and has for a long time that people invest outside of the U.S. in good foreign dividend-paying stocks. He's pretty bearish on the U.S. market because he thinks it's a big bubble. And he's probably right, I think. It just depends on whether the bubble will pop or not, because as they pump more money into the system and inflate the currency, that can just, you know, when the tide rises, all ships rise. So it can cause, you know, the markets could keep going up. You don't know exactly what's going to happen. But he recommends investing in gold and silver. I'll talk about that more later today, Lord willing. And also other commodities that tend to go up in times of inflation. Just, you know, could be other metals, could be even regular old commodities like food and things like that. All those things tend to go up in times of inflation. He recommends, another thing that he recommends is, especially right currently, he's recommending this, and he has been for a while, but he's especially now, is investing in gold and silver mining companies. These are the companies that actually mine the gold and silver out of the ground. When the price of precious metals goes up, the mining company's profit goes up, and therefore their share price goes up. If you think about it, just as an example, say you're a hog farmer. Okay, you raise hogs for a living. And for whatever reason, the price of hogs doubles. Maybe there's a hog virus out there and a bunch of hogs die. Or maybe some marketing genius for the carnivore diet manages to convince the entire country to go on the carnivore diet. And all of a sudden, there's a huge demand for hog meat. Pork, in other words, would be another name for that. swine's flesh would be another one. But so all of a sudden, the price of hogs doubles. And the hog farmer's inputs, his expenses don't double. They might go up a little bit, but he's making a lot of money now because he can sell his hogs for a lot more than he did before, right? Well, if this guy is a publicly traded hog farmer, which is probably not the case with most of them, but if he's a publicly traded company and his profit margins are going through the roof, what do you think is going to happen to his stock price? It's going to go up too, right? Because his company is profitable. Well, it works the same way with companies that are digging gold out of the ground. If the gold price goes way up, their profits go way up because the thing that they're selling goes way up. So that's, you can really benefit by investing in these mining companies when the price of precious metals is going up. And typically, the price of mining companies will go up multiples of the price of the metals themselves. So if the metals double, the mining companies will go up a lot more than double. That's usually what happens. So let me just give you a little bit of example here. This is as of April 17th, 2025, so 10 days ago. Of course, these numbers are out of date already because things change all the time, but they're not that out of date, obviously. So since as of 10 days ago, gold is up 75% from its old record high in 2011. In 2011, gold was on a bull run. It hit just a little over $1,900 per ounce. And from that point, then it went way down. I'll talk about that. But from that high point in 2011, gold is up 75% higher now than it was then. Okay, it's up, it's at $3,330 roughly per ounce, $3,330 per ounce right now. Gold mining stocks, now this is very interesting. Gold mining stocks as a group, I'm not talking about an individual miner, I'm talking about as a group, gold mining stocks are down 21% from their old record high in 2011. So in 2011, the gold price has shot up 75% since 2011. The gold mining companies have gone down 21%. And you think, well, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah, that's what I think. That's what I thought for a long time. They are going up. They've gone up a lot in recent years. But they're still not to where they were in 2011. I think the reason is that people don't believe that the gold bull market is going to last. I think they're like, oh, it's some kind of a bubble. The gold market's going to come back down. The mining companies really aren't going to be worth that much. So that could be part of the reason for that. Since 2015, so the gold market then went into a bear market. Bear market means it goes down. Bull market means it goes up. So it went into a bear market. It went down from 1900 and something in 2011 to 1,056 in the end of 2015. So it went down a lot. And that was a painful time for people that were invested in the gold market. But when you're invested in markets like these, if you look at macro trends and you say, is the government still printing money? Yep. Is the government still running huge budget deficits? Yep. Is there any end to it in sight? No. Are they ever going to cut spending? Of course not, right? So what's going to happen to the gold price? It's going to keep going up. Even though it's going down right now, it's going to go back up unless the government changes its spending habits, which is not going to happen until a crisis and they absolutely have to. So that's, you know, back then, that's years in the future. So if you're smart, if you were smart, you held on back then. You didn't sell. When it got down to 1,000, you didn't bail like a dummy. You just held on to it. And if you did, you did well. But anyway, from when it bottomed out in the end of 2015, gold is up 215% from then until now. So in 10 years, it's up 215% from 1056 to 3330. Gold mining stocks as a group are up 291% from when they bottomed out in 2015. So they're actually up more than gold is, but not that much. 215 versus 291%. It's still a lot. If you bought gold stocks 10 years ago, you made a killing. I mean, you've like quadrupled your money almost. So you know, you did really well. If you bought them in a few years before that, you still haven't made your money back yet. It just all depends, right? So in the previous, but here's a comparison. In the previous bull market in gold from 2008 to 2011, gold was up 150%, while gold mining stocks were up 265%. That's what I'm saying. So when gold goes up, gold mining stocks usually go up way more. Okay. So now in this current bull market, gold is up 215, gold stocks are up 291, right? There's probably a long way to go for these gold stocks, especially since they're lower than they were 14 years ago in 2011. This divergence will probably not last much longer before the gold mining stocks begin to outperform gold. I've thought this for a long time, but it's finally beginning to happen as those numbers just show. You know, gold mining stocks have gone up a ton in the last several years, and especially just very recently, they've gone up a lot. Actually, they are up as of 10 days ago. They're up 51% since the beginning of this year. So if you own gold mining stocks on January 1st, you have made half again your money. You know, so if you put 10 grand into gold stocks in January, just a few months ago, you've got 15 grand already, right? I think there's a large potential gain to be had at this particular time in history right now in gold mining stocks as a whole. And if you wanted to do that, you can do so by buying the VanEck Gold Miners ETF. This is not financial advice. The symbol is GDX. You can open up your Charles Schwab account and go in there and buy GDX. However, there is something you need to know. That investing in gold and silver mining stocks is risky, and the market's very volatile, as you've just seen from some of the numbers, so you want to be very cautious. This would be money that you don't need for the next 5 years or more, right? You don't take money that's in your car fund if you're planning on buying a car next year with cash, like you should, right? You don't take money and say, oh, you know what? It's up 50% the last few months. It'd be great to be up another 50% in the next few months, and then I can buy a nicer car. You know what you're going to end up buying if you do that? A clunker, because it's probably going to go down 50%, you know? That's Murphy right there, Murphy's Law. So don't invest money that you need in the short term. If you're saving for a house, don't put it in gold stocks. Trust me. I didn't do this recently, but sometimes the market can stay way lower than you think for way longer than you think. It's finally coming back, so that's good. But yeah, don't put money that you need in the short term in this kind of market. If you can't handle losing as much money in a day as you will make in a year if you put it into a CD, don't buy gold stocks. Because you will easily lose as much money in a day, often, as you would make in a year if you put that same money into a CD. You know what a CD is? Certificate of deposit. Your money's locked up for 3, 6, 9 months, a year, 5 years, whatever, at a certain interest rate. You get higher interest rates, you can get around 4% or so. You'll lose 4% in a day, no big deal. I mean, it's just not even, you won't even, you just yawn. You'll be like, oh, no, I just lost another 4%. Just no big deal, right? That's just what happens in that market. And then it's up again. You know, it's up and down. It's wild. So if you can't handle that kind of thing, if you look, I just lost X amount of, forget about it. You're going to have a heart attack before you make any money. So don't do it. But if you have money that you don't need, this is long-term money, and you're not afraid to speculate a little bit, and you're willing to risk it, I think there's a lot of money to be made there in that sector. Peter Schiff, getting back to him, he predicted the housing and the financial crisis back in 2000, or the housing crisis of 2008. He predicted it years before it happened. He was on Fox and CNN and MSNBC and all these mainstream new cable news stations, and he was predicting in 2005, 6, 7, he was predicting exactly what happened. And they all laughed at him. You want to have some fun, go Google, go YouTube, Peter Schiff was right. 2005, 2006, 2007, something like that. And you'll see a compilation video over and over. And he's saying the exact opposite of what all these other bobbleheads are saying. And they're all laughing at him and making fun of him. And exactly what he said was going to happen, happened. So not that he's right all the time, but he was right on that one. He wrote a book called Crash Proof. He wrote it in like 2005, 2006. It came out in 2007 before the crash, thankfully. And it was like Nostradamus. Like he was just, almost everything that he said is exactly what happened. And then I got version 2.0 of the book after the fact. I didn't find out about it until after the fact. And in 2.0, at the end of every chapter, he didn't change a thing. But at the end of every chapter, he basically said, here's what I said was going to happen, here's what happened. It was like, it was just uncanny. It was quite amazing. So he's also predicted the U.S. economy and the stock market are not going to crash. They're not going to do well. They're going to be outperformed by foreign and emerging markets. Even if they do go up, they're not going to keep pace with gold and with inflation is what he thinks anyway. He's bearish on the U.S. market, and time will tell if he's right. It could have been that he was just years early. I mean, what he's been saying is gold's gone through the roof. And gold stocks have been going up for a long time. But he was saying this years ago. So if you took his advice, like some other person that I know did, in 2011 and you sold out of the U.S. market and then bought into the gold mining share sector, and the U.S. market went way up and the gold mining sector went way down, you know, then, you know, it was bad timing. But if you held on, you know, it could be all right. It'll be all right. But like I said, he was definitely early at best in a lot of cases. So you might have to make up your, or you're going to have to make up your own mind whose investment advice you follow. And chances are, unless you're really into this stuff, you're probably going to forget about Schiff. And I don't blame you. I probably, if I were you and you don't know a whole lot about it, I don't think I would probably go out on that limb. Or what you could do is if you wanted to diversify a little bit, you can take out, you can have more than one IRA. You could take out one IRA and you could invest in that kind of stuff. And you could take out another IRA and you could invest in U.S. market. You know, you could try to do both. And that brings me to investing in precious metals themselves. I believe that gold and silver should be a part of every portfolio. Portfolio just means all of your investments, right? That's just a fancy term for it. I believe that everybody should have some gold and silver. They should own some physical gold and silver. Gold and silver has been valued by people for thousands of years, and that is not likely to change. Let me just give you a couple of verses here. Psalm 19 and verse 10. That's why I read Psalm 19 at the outset of the service today. Psalm 19 and verse 10. This is talking about the word of God. The words of God. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. Now this is telling us that God's words are more valuable than gold. But what it's telling us in addition to that is gold is valuable. Obviously, that's why it's comparing the word of God with gold. It doesn't say, you know, that the word of God is more to be desired than Wonder Bread or something. Obviously, right? I mean, you wouldn't, that would, yeah, of course, you know, that would be a dumb analogy. So the Lord picks like one of the most valuable, sought after things in the world, and he says his word's more valuable than that. Right, so that's the point. Like, gold is valuable and sought after, always has been, and probably always will be. I don't think that's going to change. Unless the alchemists somehow figure out how to turn lead into it or something, more than likely it's going to remain valuable. Let's look at just one more verse, Proverbs 3 and verse 13. Proverbs 3, 13 and 14. Happy is the man that findeth wisdom, and the man that getteth understanding, for the merchandise of it are better than the merchandise of silver, and the gain thereof than fine gold. Again, comparing wisdom to silver and gold. Obviously, they're valuable. The word gold and its cognates are found 489 times in the Bible. And the word silver is used 320 times. So, you know, the Bible is full of talk of gold and silver. And gold, and usually silver, will generally maintain its purchasing power over time and increase in value in terms of currency at the true inflation rate. So as governments inflate their currencies, typically gold will keep pace with that. And over time, if you had an ounce of gold 100 years ago, you can buy the same amount of stuff with it now as 100 years ago. Right? If you took people always say like a fine suit of clothing. If you took an ounce of gold back in the 1920s, you could buy a fine suit of clothing with it. If you take an ounce of gold today, you can buy a very fine suit of clothing with it today. It maintains its value. Now, more recently, it has exceeded maintaining its value. It's gone way up. But typically, over time, it maintains the value. Sometimes, during times of inflation, it goes up at a much higher rate. In the last 25 years, basically since the start of this century, gold is up over 10 times, and everything else is not. Like, for instance, a $100,000 house in the year 2000 is not worth $1 million now. It might be worth $200 or $250 or maybe even $300. It's not worth $1 million unless it, you know, some really rare case where you were in some neighborhood that just built up out of nowhere in the last 25 years or whatever. But under normal circumstances, it's not. A gallon of gas when I was a senior in high school in like 1999, 2000 was about a dollar, a little under a dollar. Thankfully, gas is not $10. gas is not done tenfold, right? Gas is almost done threefold. And in the past, here in a few years ago, it done like fivefold, but it hadn't done tenfold, right? A candy bar, when I was a kid, when gold was, you know, back at $260-some per ounce, a candy bar was 50 cents. I don't buy candy bars anymore. But back then, 50 cents. They are outrageously expensive today, but they are not $5. They have not gone up tenfold. And you could go on and on and on, right? So gold has way outpaced inflation in the last 25 years, that is. Now, you may think, well, it's probably headed for a crash now. Well, it could be. Or it could be that it's going to continue to go up for other reasons than just normal reasons that gold goes up. I'll get to that here in a second. But you never do know. So gold and silver are not an investment per se, like stocks, because they don't normally grow exponentially over time, except in times of high inflation. So if you would have invested in gold, and I'll give you an example here, in many periods during history, you would have been way better off in the U.S. stock market. But in the last 25 years, you'd have been way better off in gold. It just depends on the time period. I'll give you some numbers here. For instance, if one would have invested $100 in the S&P 500 in 1928, when the S&P was started, it would be worth about $1 million as of 2024, $982,817.82. That's a pretty good return on investment, right? $100 turned into $1 million over the course of, you know, almost 100 years. If one would have bought $100 worth of gold in 1928, it would be worth about $12,649 in 2024. It'd be worth more than that now because it's gone up a lot just even in this year. But so clearly, it wouldn't even be close, right? But the caveat there is from 1928 until 1971, the U.S. was still on the gold standard. So the gold price didn't go anywhere from 28 until 33. It was $20 an ounce. At 33, they revalued it to $35 an ounce. And then it was $35 an ounce until 1971. They might have revalued it in there somewhere at like 40-some dollars an ounce. But basically, it didn't go hardly anywhere until 1971. When Nixon took us off the gold standard and the gold window was closed and foreign central banks couldn't redeem their dollars for gold anymore, gold, the dollar was now not pegged to gold. The gold went through the roof. In the next 10 years, it went up to $800-some an ounce from 30-something in the 1970s and early 1980s. And, the dollar went down big time. And then Paul Volcker got in there. He was the chairman of the Fed in the 80s, and he raised interest rates a whole up to 20%, and he brought down inflation. That's what it would take to bring it down. That's why I don't think the Fed's going to bring it down. They raise interest rates to 20% today. Number one, it would cause like the greatest depression ever. But number two, the government's the interest on their debt would be like tens of trillions of dollars. The government would be instantly insolvent. So that's not going to happen, which means they're going to keep printing and they're going to keep inflating. And more than likely, the price of gold is going to keep going up, over time is what I think. So, if you look at it over the last 100 years, people say gold's a terrible investment. I've had people tell me, multiple people, most people hate gold, so it's funny. Multiple people, financial people tell me, in this year, gold's a terrible investment. Yeah, just bad investment. Like, have you looked at the charts in the last 25 years? Since January 2000, the price of gold went from $284 per ounce to $3,324 per ounce. That is as of 3 days ago. It actually went over $3,500 an ounce last week. It's back down a little bit now. But anyway, so it went from $284 to $3,300+, which is a 1,070.24% increase. 1,000% increase. Gold's gone up 10 times in the last 25 years. Since January 2000, the S&P 500 went from $1,469 to $5,044, which is a 270% increase. The S&P has gone up 270%. The gold has gone up almost 1,100%. Gold has absolutely murdered the S&P in the last 25 years. Absolutely killed it. And it's funny because all these financial people say, gold's a terrible investment. If they'd have invested in gold 25 years ago, they'd have like three times as much money as if they'd have put their money in the S&P. It's crazy. That's not to say that past performance equals future results. It's not to say it's going to happen again for the next 25 years. Who knows? But I'm just saying anybody that says gold's a terrible investment hasn't looked at any charts in the last 25 years. Now, you know, maybe the future will be different. Who knows? So why is it going up so much? Well, central banks have been buying gold, foreign central banks have been buying gold by the ton, literally, by the metric ton for years, especially in recent years. They are buying it massively because they see the writing on the wall. The United States, the U.S. dollar, has been the global reserve currency since 1944 at the Bretton Woods Conference. Okay, right before the end of World War II. The whole world got together in Bretton Woods up in, what was it, New Hampshire, I think it was. Got together in some swanky hotel, and they all determined the U.S. dollar is going to be the world's reserve currency. The whole world is going to be on the dollar is going to be on gold, and the whole world is going to be on the dollar. The rest of the world was destroyed. Japan's destroyed, Europe's destroyed, Germany's destroyed, the whole world's destroyed. The U.S. is the only game in town. And the U.S. benefited greatly from that deal. But the U.S. started running up started running up budget deficits, spending more money than they had coming in. And before you know it, foreign countries are looking and saying, man, they're really printing up these dollars like crazy. And they start wanting their dollar, they want to trade in their dollars for gold because the dollars aren't going to be worth as much. And then Nixon closes the gold window in 71 and so on. Well, anyway, the only thing that saved the dollar after that point, I can see I'm probably not going to get to the end of the sermon by now, but the only thing that saved the dollar by that point is that they made a deal with Saudi Arabia. He met with the king of Saudi Arabia in 1945, right before Roosevelt died, to get this deal going because he saw that, you know, Saudi Arabia had just recently discovered a huge amount of oil, and Roosevelt knew that the U.S. is going to need this oil in the future. So he started the beginnings of the petrodollar. And then when Nixon closed the gold window in 71, they made a deal with Saudi Arabia. And they said, hey, if you will only sell oil in dollars, we will provide you with military protection and technology. We got your back. We'll take care of you. You sell oil only in dollars. And that was the deal. And that's the only thing that kept the dollar. Otherwise, the dollar would be just like the Continental today, I think. All right? It'd be just like the Zimbabwe dollar. It'd be done. It would have been toast years and years and years ago. But they made the deal there. And that meant that the rest of the world had to hold dollars, because if they want to buy oil, they've got to do it with dollars, right? So that kept the dollar going for decades, for a long time, 50 years, I mean, or more. But that's starting to end now. There's, countries are moving away from the dollar. The BRICS countries, BRICS is, what's the B? Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and other ones are moving away from the dollar. This has been happening for a while, but it's happening in earnest now because Trump's done all these crazy tariffs, done all these economic threats, and the world's looking and saying, man, I mean, the U.S. is far from stable. They're putting hundreds of percents of tariffs on us. They're creating all this trade wars and economic wars, and they can probably see that this is an empire in its death throes, and it's like a last-ditch effort to try to keep the ship from sinking, basically. And so that's why I think one of the reasons why gold has been going up like crazy recently, because China and other countries have been buying a ton, literally tons of gold. They've been selling U.S. treasuries and putting their dollars into gold, which makes perfect sense. That's what I'd be doing if I was them too. So that's why I think why gold is so high. It's not because people all of a sudden took a liking to gold earrings or something like that. It's not because jewelers are buying it. It's not because everyday Americans are buying and investing in gold. Not at all. Someday they will be when they finally realize, whoa, I mean, gold's really high. Everybody will pile into it. And that's probably about the time to get out. But anyway, it's because of the central banks. Okay, so you've heard all this before, by the way. I mean, some of this is new information, you know, in the last 5 years or so, because things have, you know, have changed and gotten worse. But the question is then, how much precious metals should one own? I do not recommend putting all or the majority of your wealth in gold and silver. I don't recommend doing that. Anybody that tells you to put everything you have in gold and silver is an idiot. You don't put everything you have in anything. That's a bad idea. Typically, doing that in a normal economy would not be a good idea, because it's going to, you know, keep up with inflation, and that's about it. It's not going to grow your wealth like it would if you were in good quality stocks in normal times. We're not exactly in normal times right now, so it's hard to tell. During times of high inflation, though, as we've seen, gold outperformed the stock market by like crazy amounts. Some people recommend putting 5 to 10% of one's net wealth in gold, while others recommend in times of high inflation to put more in it. So, you know, 10% of your net wealth, if you consider that with your house and everything you own, if your net wealth, if you got a $500,000 net worth, that means $50,000 in gold, right? Or whatever. Something like that. If you got $1 million net worth, $100,000 in gold. You got $100,000 net worth, $10,000 in gold, right? That would be 10%. So that's what a lot of people that are like, think about gold, that's what people generally recommend. And they recommend more in times of high inflation. You know, maybe some people recommend up to 25%. So, you know, it's going to be obviously up to you whether you own that much or any for that matter. It's everybody's choice. The last time I recommended buying gold and silver was in March of 2020. You'll probably remember that. That was when the COVID thing was going on, right at the very beginning of it. And I did a sermon on Be Careful for Nothing, I think it was called. The first part of the sermon was not, it was recorded, but it wasn't put on the website. It's when I talked about all this kind of stuff. Then the second part, I talked about other stuff. So that part wasn't recorded. But at that time, I again recommended buying gold and silver, especially silver at that time. I had recommended it back in 2014 and prior to that, but definitely in the blowing the trumpet sermon in 2014, gold was probably at like 1300 and something an ounce or something back then. I don't remember recommended it. Well, anyway, in 2020, 5 years ago, I just looked this up. When I recommended it, gold was at 1600. So if you'd taken my advice back then, you'd have doubled your money. Now, does that mean if you take it now, you're going to double your money? I have no idea. You might half your money, have your money, like H-L-A-V-E, your money. I don't know. I told you at the time, silver is super, super cheap. I mean, I couldn't emphasize this enough. If I'd have had it to do over again, depending on the amount you were going to buy, just to calm your nerves, I would have told you, if you buy silver now, I will buy it back from you at this price no matter what. If silver goes down to $1 per ounce, I will buy it back from you at $12. That's what I should have told you, and that might have encouraged you to buy it. I was that certain that silver was going to go way up because it was insanely cheap. The gold-silver ratio, as I told you at the time, was 120, which means gold was 120 times more expensive than silver, which is way out of whack, way out of whack. Historically, it's like 16. It's in more modern history, it's maybe been like the 40s or 50s, but it was 120 back then. Silver was $12 an ounce. It's $33 an ounce now. It's almost tripled in 5 years. So, you know, that ship has sailed. The question is it still a good buy or not? I still think silver is a good buy. It's the gold-silver ratio is still at 100. You know, gold is still 100 times more expensive than silver. So I think silver's got a lot more room to go. The only thing to consider about that is, though, is central banks don't buy silver typically. The silver market's too small for central banks, and you have to buy so much. You think about it, if you're a central bank and you want to preserve your country's wealth, you could either buy a ton of gold or you could buy 100 tons of silver, right? And you could ship 100 tons of silver, and you could build vaults to put 100 times more silver in there to get the same wealth. So central banks don't buy silver. They buy gold. And silver also has industrial uses and is more of an industrial metal than gold is. So when the economy goes down, silver can go down, even if gold might be going up, or it could go down relative to gold because gold doesn't have that industrial component to it as much. So in an environment like today's, where the dollar could lose its global reserve currency status, and I think that is likely, I don't know exactly when that's going to happen, but would I be surprised if it happened within 5 years? No, I wouldn't. Would I be surprised in 10 years? Not at all. It could, I mean, I think the writing's on the wall, but it just, who knows how long, you know, that's going to take and what's going to happen. But in an environment like this, where the dollar could lose its global reserve currency status and inflation could soar, it might make sense to have more than 5 to 10% of your net worth in gold, possibly even much more than that. But I think everybody ought to have some anyway. I mean, for goodness sakes, if you can't afford to invest in silver, tell me, I'll give you some money. If you are that hard up, if you are that poor, you can't afford $33 for an ounce of silver, tell me. I mean, you obviously need like money for groceries or something. Anybody can buy some silver, and that's no big deal. But anyway, it's up to you whether you do it or not. If you don't think it's a good idea, don't do it. But, you know, if you're thinking, well, I can't afford it, well, you can afford $33. Anybody can. All right, now let's look at another type of investment, and that is real estate. This is another option to build wealth. This would be an option, and I will get to this at the very end. This is, in my opinion, and the advice that I will give, this is only an option for people who have money. If you don't have money, and I mean like hundreds of thousands of dollars that you can buy real estate with cash, forget about it. Do not buy real estate other than a primary residence. Do not buy it if you can't pay cash for it. Very bad idea. Good way to lose your shirt. Ask Dave Ramsey about it. He became a millionaire in his 20s, and he went bankrupt in his 20s because he was levered up in real estate. Bad idea. But real estate investing is biblical. It's biblical to purchase real estate. Let's look at Jeremiah 32 and verse 44. Jeremiah 32, 44. It says, men shall buy fields for money and subscribe evidences and seal them and take witnesses in the land of Benjamin and in the places about Jerusalem and in the cities of Judah and in the cities of the mountains and in the cities of the valley and in the cities of the south, for I will cause their captivity to return, saith the Lord. Okay, so just to show you an example of, you know, this is buying real estate's been a biblical practice forever. And they had deeds. That's basically subscribing evidence and all that. They had deeds just like we did today, right? And you'd sign on the line and seal it and have witnesses and all that. I mean, people have been doing this forever. It's also biblical to invest in real estate for the future. Verses 6 through 15 here in Jeremiah 32. Jeremiah 32, 6 through 15. And Jeremiah said, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, behold, Hanamel, the son of Shallum, thine uncle, shall come unto thee, saying, buy thee my field that is in Anathoth, for the right of the redemption is thine to buy it. So Hanamel, mine uncle's son, came to me in the court of the prison, according to the word of the Lord, and said unto me, buy my field, I pray thee, that is in Anathoth, which is in the country of Benjamin, for the right of inheritance is thine, and the redemption is thine, buy it for thyself. Then I knew that this was the word of the Lord. And I bought the field of Hanamel, my uncle's son, that was in Anathoth, and weighed him the money, even 17 shekels of silver. Here Jeremiah is in prison, and he still is a cash buyer. Jeremiah didn't go to some banker and sign on the line and promise to pay him for the next 30 years and pay four times as much for the property as it's worth and all this stuff. Jeremiah gave him the money, laid him out the silver, weighed it out to him, and paid for it. And I subscribed the evidence and sealed it and took witnesses and weighed him the money in the balances. So I took the evidence of the purchase that both that which was sealed according to the law and custom, and that which was open. And I gave the evidences of the purchase unto Baruch, the son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, in the sight of Hanamel, mine uncle's son, and in the presence of the witnesses that subscribed the book of the purchase before all the Jews that sat in the court of the prison. See, I mean, just like today, you go down to the courthouse, you'd register the deed or whatever, like record the deed down there. It's the same thing. I mean, they've been doing this forever. And I charged Baruch before them, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, take these evidences, this evidence of the purchase, both which is sealed, and this evidence which is open, and put them in an earthen vessel, that they may continue many days. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, houses and fields and vineyards shall be possessed again in this land. This was an investment for the future. The Babylonians are coming, they're going to take over, but eventually, I'm going to give you back your land, and you're going to come back and you're going to have this land that you bought, and it's going to have been a good investment. You know, so investing in real estate is not a bad idea. Depending. I mean, it all depends. I mean, it can be a bad idea too, but you know, the general idea of it is not a bad idea. Now, there are different ways that you can make money in real estate. I mean, this isn't rocket science. I'm probably not telling you anything you don't know. But you can buy land, or you can buy buildings, houses, or whatever, and sell them at a later date after they appreciate, right? You can make money that way. And if you're savvy and you can have some foresight and you can see that, you know, things are creeping. Like, for instance, if you bought land outside of Liberty between here and Excelsior Springs, and you thought, you know, in the next 25 years, this is probably going to be a bunch of McMansions the whole way up Route 69 here, because Excelsior is going to be the new Liberty and Kansas City is going to, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But if it does, and you bought some of that farmland out there and then sold it to a developer in 25 years from now, you could probably make a lot of money. I'm not telling you to do this. You know, just an example. I don't know anything. I'm just, you know, just an example. You can also do rental properties. You can buy houses, duplexes, apartment complexes, things like that, and you can rent them out. You get rental income from them, right? So that's an option as well. Now, I've done a little bit of math, and I mean, like I said, I don't know much about this, but given rental house purchasing, house prices here in our town and rental prices, it just doesn't seem to me that you can make a lot of money in renting. I don't know. Now, I mean, there are some tax advantages, and I didn't factor that in. But, I mean, it looked to me like, man, you just put that money in a high-yield savings account, you'd do just about as good as if you bought a house with cash and rented it out to people when it's all said and done with taxes and maintenance and insurance and all that stuff. But, like I said, I don't know anything, so don't listen to me on that topic because, you know, I'm not an expert on that. But I have been told that there are places, different places in the country where housing prices and rental prices are much better, that rental prices are a lot higher relative to housing prices than they are here. And in that case, you know, you could make money doing rentals. But maybe you can here too, I don't know. But there are various tax advantages to real estate. And I'm just going to read you some quotes here from a Forbes article called The Top Tax Benefits of Real Estate Investments in 2024. One of the real estate investments most compelling, one of real estate investments most compelling tax benefits is the ability to defer capital gains taxes through a 1031 exchange. This strategy allows you to sell a rental or commercial property and reinvest the proceeds into a like-kind property without triggering an immediate tax liability. By deferring capital gains taxes, you can preserve more capital for reinvestment, compounding your wealth over time. For instance, if you sell a property with significant appreciation and reinvest in a higher value property, you continue to grow your portfolio without losing capital to taxes. The IRS has guidelines for this process, including identifying a replacement property within 45 days and completing the transaction within 180 days. I don't know if you understood any of that mumbo jumbo or not, but what they're basically saying is, say you bought a house for $100,000, okay? And you bought it out, you're renting it out to somebody, and say you did this especially in 2018, okay? And then Now that house is worth $200,000, which is not a stretch, right? So you bought it for $100,000, you rented it out for a few years, you sell it for $200,000. You have a $100,000 capital gain, right? Normally, like if you were did that with a stock, you owe the IRS, depending on your income, probably 15% on that capital gain. So you're going to pay them $15,000 in taxes on that $100,000 capital gain. And there's no way of getting around that. But with real estate, if you sold that $200,000 house and you bought another house for $250,000, you don't owe any capital gains as long as you did it within, you know, you found it within 45 days and completed the transaction within 180 days, you owe no capital gains. So you get to keep all that money. And instead of, if this rule wasn't there, you would have actually only had $185,000 to reinvest because you'd had to pay $15,000 in capital gains. This way, you could reinvest it. You know, you could buy a $15,000 more valuable property and, you know, keep that going. So that's a big tax benefit. Here's another one in from this article. Depreciation is another tax benefit that sets real estate apart. Even as your property appreciates in value, the IRS allows you to deduct the depreciation of the building over time, typically 27.5 years for residential properties and 39 years for commercial properties. This non-cash expense reduces your taxable income, saving you thousands of dollars annually. So that's a great deal too, because even though your property value is going up in value, the IRS allows you to depreciate it over 27 years, saying that you're losing money on a property that's actually gaining money, which is great. I mean, you can make money there. You can do better with that investment with the tax benefits. That's just going to end up saving you money on taxes in your regular tax that you're paying for the next 27 years when you're paying income tax. You're just going to pay less income tax because that depreciation is like you've just lowered your taxable income. So, you know, that can be a benefit too. And then lastly, here's the last quote. Certain types of real estate investments come with valuable tax credits. For example, projects that involve historic building restoration or low-income housing development may qualify for federal and state tax credits. These credits directly reduce your tax liability, offering dollar-for-dollar savings. So that is an option, but it also comes with its share of headaches. I've never been a landlord myself, but my dad used to be a landlord years ago. My brother has been a landlord a couple different times, and it's a pain in the butt, right? There's a lot of things to consider, especially if you're doing low-income housing, because then you're a slumlord, and then you're dealing with the scum of the earth, and they're going to trash your place, they're going to have all kinds of filthy animals in it, and it's just going to be a total mess. It's not for me, definitely not. If I were going to invest in real estate, it would only be if I could buy decent properties where like normal middle class people would be renting. And even then, there's a lot of pigs out there and jerks, but you'd be less likely to find pigs and jerks probably, you know, as you go up the socioeconomic ladder a little bit. Not to sound like a jerk myself, but that's just the way it is. I hate to tell you. I mean, it is. So you got like the headaches of dealing with tenants who might not pay you, or they might trash your property. I mean, you know, most of us just think like, well, yeah, you pay your rent, of course. Like, that's what every normal, decent person does. I hate to tell you, there are a lot of people out there that don't share that same value. Like, paying their rent is not just a given. It's like, oh, well, why would I? You know, I mean, if I can live here for free versus paying for it, I'd rather live here for free. And I can do that for several months or for a while until the landlord finally comes after me. And then I can move out during the night. I can leave all my crappy furniture in here for him to clean up the mess. And I can go rent some other place. And then I can rent there for free for a while. That's what people do. I'm telling you, I have neighbors that have done it. I know what I'm talking about. I know what I'm talking about. And I didn't even mention this. If another scamdemic comes along, can you imagine being a landlord when the government says your tenants do not have to pay you? When the government says, screw you, to property owners, to landlords. And they went for a long time where their tenants didn't have to pay them. Now, some of their tenants who weren't dirtbags paid them anyway, but plenty of tenants probably didn't pay them. And there's nothing they could do legally. It's crazy. Not to mention squatters' rights. You could have a rental property, somebody could move out, some homeless bum could move in there, and you can't get him out. I don't know what Missouri law is with that, but there are some places in the country, forget about it. Real estate's also a lot of work, like taking care of the maintenance, leasing, collecting rent, evictions, dealing with the tenants. You can hire property managers to do that for you, but then that cuts into your bottom line. And if you hire somebody to do all the maintenance for you, that's going to cut your bottom line, right? So it's not all it's cut out to be, I don't think, based on the experience of people that I know anyway. And like I said, I said this at the beginning and I will say it again. I don't know if I have time to move on to the next section or not, but the one number one rule to remember when you're investing in real estate, pay cash. Pay cash. If you can't pay cash, you can't afford to invest in real estate. Forget about it. If you don't have at least a couple hundred thousand dollars to play with, you can't afford real estate. Because if it's less than that, you're buying some dump, and then you're going to deal with a dump, and you're going to deal with people that live in dumps, and you're going to deal with all that. So I'd say if you don't have $200,000, like in addition to your other wealth, is $200,000 that you just want to do this thing with, forget about real estate until you've got that kind of money. That's my advice, though, anyway. Take it or leave it. You could learn the hard way like Dave Ramsey did, if you want to. All right, let's see. Should I get into financial advisors? I don't know. Let me see. How much do I have to go here? It hasn't been an hour yet. I think I can probably... I don't know. I'm going to take a vote. Do you want to hear more or do you not? All right. I don't want to put you on the spot. I'll just quit. I'll do it next time. I don't want to overwhelm you. I know I think I could do it in 15 minutes, but then I know myself too, and it might be a half an hour. So anyway, let's just call it quits. I'll talk about financial advisors next Sunday, Lord willing, and give you some pointers on what to look for, what kind of questions to ask, how to pick one, and so on. So we'll save that till next week. So I thank you again for your attention this morning, and I hope you learned something that was valuable to take home with you.